Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your weekend is not complete without the First Lady of New York Radio. It's the Joan Hamburg Show, Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Welcome to the Joan Hamburg Show. We do this Sunday and every Sunday starting at 2 o'clock. And today, one of the hottest stars on Broadway, straight from the stage of Funny Girl, tapping his way into your heart, Jared Grimes. He's going to be our guest along with Melissa Rivers. So you be there too, right now, starting at 2 o'clock.
The First Lady of New York Radio. This is Joan Eats.
All right, everyone. A week from Monday is Memorial Day. Now, think, what does that mean? It means hot dogs. And it's the biggest, you know, our crew guests. It's time to grill hot dogs. It's the rites of summer. So, a couple of little secrets. Our producer, who grew up in New Jersey, told us that her father, who doesn't live anywhere near Newark, would go around this time of year to Newark, New Jersey, to 144 Avon Avenue, and there's a place called Best Provisions Company, and her dad would go and buy, which he says, are the most incredible hot dogs, better than anything they've ever had. And that reminded me that my pal, one of the great foodies, Arthur Schwartz, right, the food maven, he told me, too, years ago, about Best Provisions. They're open Monday till Friday, 6 a.m. to 4 p.m., Saturdays till 1. And if you're going anywhere near Newark Airport, and you're not going exciting places, go to a hot dog place. All you have to do, I couldn't find it when I try to go. If you put it in your GPS, the place is 10 minutes from Newark Airport. However, it's in an urban area and it's hard to find. So I'm not so good at directions. I'm a lefty and I'm telling you, it screws up your whole head when it comes to directions. But the GPS got me there. The place is in a brick factory building by a loading gate. That's why you'd miss it. And there's parking. The family has been in the hot dog deli business since 1938. And I'm always amazed by how many friends in New Jersey never heard of it. It's the factory store, and this is the only place you can get Best natural casing hot dogs. They do sell their skinless hot dogs, grocery stores. They're good, but you want the ones with the natural casing. And of course, 5-pound packages, $26.75, cash only. And when we were there, we spoke to Eddie at the store, and he said, many of the famous New Jersey Italian hot dog stands use their natural casing hot dog and have for years. The factory store also sells roast beef, corned beef, pastrami, delicious beef bologna, and knackwurst. Everything they make right there. I mean, you believe me, you go to your regular places, that isn't the story. So if you can go to the factory, view it as an adventure, you can get their skinless beef hot dogs, too, and shop there. Or go to Shop and Stop, ShopRite, Key Foods, Food Time, Acme, and you can get any of those too. So, you know, I never used to like hot dogs. I think maybe it's the craziness of the times, but what's satisfying, more satisfying, right off the grill, a plump, fantastic hot dog with natural casing. You know, when you bite into it and you hear that snap, that's a hot dog. That's a really good hot dog. And if you want a really good hot dog, you want a Best provision company, Otto. So enjoy every bite. We've got a lot of show coming up. I'm Joan Hamburg.
Taking you behind the curtain, it's the Joan Hamburg Show. Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Well, people are always asking us what to do, where to go, what should they do in theater. And we love theater and we celebrate it. I always loved Funny Girl and I love it still. And every time you see a show, even if you've seen it before, it's a brand new experience. So that's how you have to come to it. Just let it take over. And that's what happened when I went to see Funny Girl. And you're going to love it. And one of the great scenes is a tap dancing scene. And Jared Grimes, who plays Eddie Ryan in Funny Girl, brings the house down. Now, I've seen Jared work before, but I'm telling you, there was something magical about that. So, Jared, congratulations on everything. So happy to have you with us today. And I'm
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You know, eight shows is a lot, but it's worth every exhaustion moment.
For sure.
So let's start really at the beginning. You were just a kid when your mother had the good sense to teach you how to tap, right? 3 years old?
Yeah, 3 years old. She was always working on dance routines downstairs, and I would wake up early in the morning, and I would see her and her friends down there working on those routines. And I just slowly but surely, you know, I started to pick up some of the steps. I wanted to dance with them, and I wanted to be like my mom. So tap wasn't even her first love. It was actually the one she feared the most out of all the genres. But for some reason, I latched on to that one.
Well, I think that, and that's a great kid thing, because not only is it fun to do, but it makes noise. And
oh, my gosh. It makes noise, and it's loud, and, you know, you can bang and all day long. As soon as you wake up, even when you're asleep, you can still tap dance. So,
now, was your
all for that type of energetic, you know.
Right. And Jared, was your mom a professional dancer?
Yeah, she was, on and off. She had a dance company in Jamaica, Queens called Sunshine Dance Company, and they used to perform and tour around the New York area for the most part. And that's pretty much, you know, the extent of her professional career was, you know,
teaching,
bootstrapping her own dance program and teaching workshops around and preparing young Black kids for the industry. And that's what her passion was. And she's a school teacher, too. So her passion was more about teaching dance,
right,
and teaching academics.
And then when the family moved to North Carolina, it's funny because you moved. I knew High Point because I knew people in the furniture business. And that was a big deal there.
Mm-hmm. So, furniture market, High Point. I don't know why my parents picked High Point, but I think at the time I was 6 years old, I think their mode of thinking was it was this new upstart town that had like a lot of potential, which today High Point is huge.
Right.
But when we moved there, like in the early 90s, it was smaller. I mean, I remember it was all forest. It was all woods. There were really not too many businesses. The city was pretty small. And then, you know, I look up now and it's almost the same size and has the same popularity and draw as Charlotte or Raleigh, North Carolina. So it's definitely gotten bigger, and my parents were right. And the dance scene was really big there, too, in terms of dance schools. There were a lot of dance schools, and I think that's what attracted my parents to the area because they knew I could kind of continue dancing and growing in the arts.
Well, and you did. You became part of a company. You started touring. But how did you get, like, you toured at one point with Mariah Carey. How does something like that happen when you're so young?
Oh, man, I was a senior in college. And, yeah, I had a math class coming up, and, you know, my dance agent called me, and they were like, hey, Mariah Carey's doing an audition for her press tour, the first leg of her Emancipation of Mimi tour. And they were like, do you have time to run over there real quick? And I'm in between classes. So I'm like, man, should I skip math today, or should I go to the... this audition, you know, usually when you go to auditions like that, there might be like 100, 200, you know, dancers vying for, you know, maybe five slots.
Of course.
In this particular case, there were maybe a little bit under 100, and they were all buying. We were all buying for one slot because she had already hired dancers from LA. So they were in New York and they were looking for one more dancer. And I was like, wow. So I mean, you know, the odds of this are kind of, you know, low, but the choreographer that was on the project, he was the choreographer, Marty Kudelka, who's Justin Timberlake's go-to choreographer. He was somebody that I just at least wanted to learn from. So I was like, you know, at the worst, you know, I could go to the audition and at least have a free class from this choreographer just to get the experience. And I ended up getting the job, and we started rehearsals literally right after the audition. So I couldn't even make it to math class. So I called my teacher and I told them why, and they were like, "Oh yeah, by all means, yeah. That's, you know, at this point in time, that's way better than these complex equations." So, so I found myself on tour with one of the legends in pop music.
Without question, I'm talking to Jared Grinds, and Jared does it all. He sings, he dances, he acts. He's a great choreographer. He's one of the stars of Funny Girl. And if you've just joined us, we were talking about how it was almost a fluke. He auditioned for Mariah Carey, and is, you know, anything about theater and showbiz, everyone wants to do that if they dance or sing. And yet you got it. So what happened when you came back after that tour?
You know what? I just had a new perspective and outlook on, you know, what the business was. Being a backup dancer, that was my first backup dancing job, actually. So I was just like, wow, like, you know, I got to see how Mariah Carey operated in rehearsals. I got to see how, you know, the band operated on tour and how her backup singers operated on tour. And that was like my first close-up glimpse to show business in terms of on a professional level. And I was just, I remember thinking, man, if I could, you know, if I could be the leader of my own universe in that right, kind of like, you know, Mariah Carey, maybe more in a Gregory Hines type of way or in a Sammy Davis Jr. kind of way, you know, that would be awesome, because I just, the rush that I got from just being on stage, and I wasn't even the focal point, you know, I was just like, oh man, that's the kind of rush that I live for. And it's a different type of rush. Like, you know, I've been performing my entire life, but, you know, to be on, you know, MTV and perform on BET and, you know, to perform on Good Morning America and stuff like that, that was a different type of commercial aesthetic than what I was used to. You know, everything else is, you know, up until that point was a little bit more, you know, regional theater or, you know, small kind of commercials, you know, the building blocks to becoming, you know, building your career. And that was kind of like the pinnacle at that point. I was just like, oh man, I want this. Like, I want stuff like this. I want to be able to reach the masses in the way that Mariah Carey reached the masses when we were on tour. And, you know, although it's Mariah Carey, that's a high bar to jump to so soon, you know, in my career. But I instantly
jumped.
Never forgot what that felt like, and I wanted it. So I just kind of worked hard towards, you know, that standard, you know, of entertainment in my own way. And that's when doors started opening. I started backup dancing for more artists after that. I think right after that, I was dancing with Busta Rhymes, Salt and Pepper, the Artist Common. You know, everything kind of broke open for me in terms of backup dancing. And I got to see how all these artists operated. And I was just like, yeah, like, I get it. I understand. From seeing them, you know, from being backstage with Usher, and, you know, being in a room with Justin Timberlake and having a conversation with, you know, guys like John Legend and, you know, Justin.
Oh my gosh, it's
big, you know, and
time.
Usher, to a certain degree, I was just like, man, I was like, I want to be like them, you know, for my generation, but in a Sammy Davis Jr., Fred Astaire, you know, Gregory Hines kind of way. So I really, those moments were important for me early on, because I felt like I was supposed to be in that room with those guys.
And it happened. I'm talking to Jared Grinds, who plays Eddie Ryan in Funny Girl. And we're going to let you hear much more, because here you get a big break. You go on tour. You start meeting the major players. So at what point, you know, obviously it's a tough business to make a living in. And I know you did a lot of work. You were tapping away in the subways in New York. Was that after the tour? When did that part start happening?
Before I got to college. So I was still in high school in the late late 90s. I would say like 99, maybe 98. And I would come back and forth, you know, from North Carolina to New York to just study, take classes with the choreographer. That was my tap moment in Funny Girl, Ayodele Cassell. I would drive back and forth to take classes with teachers like her. She was one of my first mentors. Mm. And I made friends from doing that. And the friends that I made, they just happened to you know, perform in the subways. Just for money and just for the sheer love of the craft and just the closeness that it brings you to, you know, a New York audience. And so, you know, when I was in high school, I used to drive up, take classes, and then in between classes and on downtime, I used to go with the guys and go under the subway and perform. our favorite, yeah, I would tap. I mean, they would have their buckets and they would be bucket drumming, and I would pull out a board, and me and, you know, the likes of Dewitt Fleming and another great tap dancer, friends of ours, we go out there and we perform for hours on end just because we enjoyed it, and we were pushing the craft and we were growing, we were evolving in the art form. And then when I got here college, you know, throughout the 2000s, I think I performed all the way from, you know, 2001 all the way to like maybe 2003.
Wow. And you made money
in the subways. Yeah, mainly. I mean, that wasn't even the main goal. The main goal was to really just push yourself.
Exactly.
I mean, there's something about, you know, performing in a subway or performing on a sidewalk for New York that it's an experience, you know, that relates to no other in my entire life. It's just so raw. It's surrender completely to, you know, the energy of New York City, the people right at you. Unlike being on a stage, because they're a little bit further away from you, but they're like, they form a circle right around you, and they connect to you in a different way. And it was the best training ground for me to prepare for the stage, because if you're used to trying to catch someone's attention in New York City with a pair of tap shoes as they're walking by, typically late for an appointment already, and if you can get that person to stop and take you in a little bit, then, you know, that's an amazing, you know, that's an amazing accomplishment.
No, especially without question.
Most people don't have time for you. So that's what that was all about. The stamina, it was the passion, it was the urge to really, really get people to want to connect with you, relate with you, love with you. All the things that human beings can be with one another, that's the most positive aspects about them. If you could get somebody to share that with you in that moment that you're on that board, you know, on the sidewalk or in the subway, that's what it was all about. Sometimes you close your eyes and you open them and there's, you know, over 100 people there. And sometimes you close your eyes and open them and there's just one, you know, little girl standing there, you know, dancing with you. And that's what it's all about, you know.
But you also had this incredible ambition and burning. And even when there were moments of disappointment, you didn't give up. And there, you know, I have actors in the family and people in that industry, and so many of their friends would say, if I don't get it by the time I'm 30 or 35, I'm done. You know, how much longer can I do this? But you can't really think like that, right? Because
no.
Especially in your area, too, where there are so many dancers and so many people who want what you want.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. You know, everybody has a plan B and a plan C for certain things like that. I had always told myself that, you know, once I really matured in the art form, and there's no way you can ever fully mature in music. The music is infinite. But I think when I really started to gain my bearings and understand just what type of instrument I was working with,
uh-huh.
I think that's when a lot of things changed for me. I told myself, I was like, look, you know, if I don't achieve the goals that I'm supposed that I want to achieve, then that really doesn't matter. I think first and foremost, what I really made my mission statement as I started to gain my bearings in the art form and all the things that I was passionate about, I was like, you know, it should be about something bigger. It should be about giving. You know, it shouldn't be about what I want. It should be about, you know, giving people the history of a lot of Black performers that came before me that sacrificed a lot in order for me to even have conversations like this right now, who paved the way for me to even be, you know, nominated or to be on a Broadway stage or to even dance with Mariah Carey. I was like, it should be about them. I want to give people a piece of their legacy, of their spirit, of their fight, their struggle, And I completely removed myself from the equation at that point. And, you know, I made it about giving, you know, giving the history, giving the knowledge, giving, you know, life to those performers who a lot of people may not know about and a lot of history mm-hmm. books did not, you know, write about. It was all about giving, and I made that my mission statement. And it's funny because as soon as I changed my mindset to that, that's when a lot more doors
started
to open up. And I was just like, wow, if I would have, you know, if I would have known that a little bit earlier, not that it's some trick to getting doors open, but, you know, I made it about something bigger than, you know, how hard I work or bigger than being the best, you know, triple threat performer ever, you know, bigger than, you know, trying to be like my idols. I just made it about, you know, preserving the legacy. You know, that's when, you know, the door started opening up for me. And that's when, you know, there was no time mark on anything that I did. You know, I was satisfied if I just made my mission statement that till the day I was no more. You know, there was no time scale at that point. I was content and I was happy with really making things about them.
But so where did Funny Girl come in? Now, you've been working now, and, you know, people know you, and you're doing more and more. But did you read about it, hear about it? Did your agent call you and say, hey, there's a good role in this for you?
At the time, I was filming Manifest on Netflix. Uh-huh. We're in our fourth season, so everything was kind of focused in on that job at hand. And, I get auditions and self tapes and stuff like that, you know, intermittently throughout the weeks and stuff like that. And, you know, my agents had shown me, you know, Funny Girl. And I was like, oh, cool. I was like, I know the movie to a certain extent. I know the characters. I know the story. And, you know, usually when something comes across my desk, since I've been doing so much choreography, I was like, oh, is this, you know, for choreography or
is it?
They were like, no, it's, they were like, it's for
an actor.
It's for an actor that plays the choreographer in the show. And that's when I was like, oh, come on. And I was like, that's actually, you know, even more perfect. Because I love to, you know, be that dual threat type of performer, which, you know, I'm working behind the table on some projects, choreographing or, you know, dabbling in directing and then also performing. Like, I always want to be that person that's the jack of all trades when it comes to it. Everything behind the table and in front of the table or behind the camera and in front of the camera. And I was like, okay, Eddie Ryan. I was like, okay, cool. I was like, I'm pretty sure in the version that I remember, Eddie Ryan was not black. And they were like, yeah, they're open to different ethnicities for the. And I was like, oh man, this could be a great opportunity for, you know, the mission statement that I just spoke about previously. And I was like, it's, you know, early 1800s, a guy that's playing a choreographer that's a best friend and ride or die to a young Jewish rising star. I was like, this is an amazing story, and there's a lot of layers that I could bring to this character that, you know, may have never been done before.
Right, and they made the character
comedy.
The character became more important. Harvey Firestone, you know, rewrote it and put a lot into it. So there was
he told me I was a real person. Yeah, he told me I was a real person. That's when my heart. We opened up and I realized that, you know, we were all on the same page in terms of, you know, exactly what Eddie would mean to the universe of our version of Funny Girl. And, you know, sadly, I think in the original, the part was a smaller part. And this time, you know, we were in the room, I was trying things and I was talking about all the things that I was just talking about, my mission statement and, you know, immersing myself in Bojangles Robinson and John Bubbles and Bill Bailey and Baby Lawrence and the Nicholas Brothers and, you know, all those great performers that I watched growing up. And I was, you know, I was crafting Eddie, you know, in the spirit of those guys. And, you know, every day was, you know, was a challenge in terms of how to bring that to the story without compromising the, you know, the arc of the entire story. And, you know, one day when I really felt good about some of the choices that I made, Harvey pulled me to the side and he was like, that's it. He was like, Eddie is a real person. And as soon as he said that, you know, they started adding some more lines and stuff like that and arcing him out just a little bit more in the second half and in the first half, actually. And we found, you know, our version of Eddie, the African-American Eddie. I'm super proud of the way I pay homage on stage every night to, like I said, all those who paved the way.
No, it's exciting. Was your family there for opening night?
They were not. My mom has come. my parents aren't really big on opening nights. They like to come when, you know,
when it's,
you know, when
established,
the show is well oiled and everything. Now, even though by the time you get to an opening night, it is, but, you know, my parents, they always sneak in and they kind of surprise me and they pull that, hey, I'm in town. I'm going to come see the show. And I'm like, oh, for sure. So my mom came over Mother's Day and she saw the original.
Yeah.
And she was just super excited. She had no idea that, you know, the Eddie character would kind of
be so,
you know,
big.
hit audiences in the way that, you know, we've been fortunate enough to do with our version of the show. And she thought it was really, you know, respectful and dignified. And it made her proud. You know, on Mother's Day, that was one of the biggest gifts I could give
great.
Her.
It sounds great. And when she saw her kid, you, do that solo tap routine, she thought it was really worth pushing that 3-year-old to learn to dance.
I mean, it's funny. It's just joy. She sees that smile. She's seen that smile since day one. So she knows when when I get in the time machine and I go back and I just, you know, I just bask in the joy of all those performers that came before me.
Well, you do a great job. We love seeing you and the whole cast. Funny girl. And take yourself over. Go get a ticket. It's going to make you feel happy. We have a crazy world. And it's just amazing to be able to sit in the theater and let magic occur and take your mind off all the bad things and just celebrate all the good things. Congratulations, Jared. I look forward to your continued success and we'll talk again.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me today.
Anytime. I'm Joan Hamburg with Jared Grimes as Eddie Ryan in Funny Girl and much more ahead here on WABC.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
First Lady of New York Radio, Joan Hamburg, entertaining and informative. Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Welcome, one and all, to the Joan Hamburg Show. And I haven't talked to Melissa Rivers, Joan's daughter, in a long time. And then, of course, her new book came out, Lies My Mother Told Me, Tall Tales from a Short Woman. And I got the biggest kick out of it. I heard Joan in her daughter's voice. Melissa, your mom would have loved this book and been so proud of you, enjoyed every minute of it. And what a perfect time, because we all thought Joan Rivers right at the Oscars when that little incident happened with the slap that people are still talking about.
Absolutely. You know, my running joke has been she would have said, thank you for the new house. Because there's so much material.
No, absolutely. And I'm sure that when that happened, your phone started ringing like crazy. What would Joan Rivers have done?
Oh, it's been nonstop. She would have been horrified. I mean, you knew her well enough to know that would have absolutely just she would have been so upset.
Well, you know, as much as your mother was in someone's face, if she had to be, she never really, as far as I knew, ever exhibited any kind of really bad behavior. I can't imagine her ever even thinking of anything like that.
Oh, no, not never. But I do think it would be frightening to her. As it is, I think, to a lot of comedians, that it's now almost open season.
Dangerous, right. Right.
Very.
It's dangerous. By the way, if you've just joined me, I'm talking to Melissa Rivers. And Melissa is herself an award-winning personality on TV. She's a producer. She's written best-selling books. And the newest, Lies My Mother Told Me, Tall Tales from a Short Woman, is really funny. And it's Joan, and it's this mother-daughter joined at the hip. And it's funny because even growing up, the three of you, your dad, your mom, and you, you were a really tight unit. And whatever your mother did, traveling all the time on the road, you, I always got the feeling, did you ever feel like you were the deserted kid or no?
Oh, God, no. You know, there were points, you know, where my parents were the parents that made it to every game. And when you're a teenager, you're like, oh, please stop already.
Right. Give me a break.
I never felt that way at all. Even as an adult, I was like, God, too much. Like, you know, leave me alone.
Well, she actually moved in with you at a time, I remember.
Yeah, she was living with Cooper and me probably 3 days a week, sometimes four, when we were doing Fashion Police and the reality show and all that all at once. So she was very much in the house.
Well, and your mom, and it's actually in the book, but she had this tradition that you included called Grandma Week. She was obsessed with your child. And that was so, everyone who knew her was like, we can't believe that's Joan Rivers. She worshiped that little boy, now a big boy.
Yeah, he's 21.
I know, hard to believe.
Cooper is 21 and a junior at Berkeley.
Mm. And does he want to go into the family entertainment world?
No, he's much more interested in new media and is a media studies major. So he's really into sort of the next wave of all of that. He has, you know, no desire to be in front of the camera. And he's much more interested in this whole sort of wild west of the new world of entertainment.
Right. And it is. It's a new language all over again.
Yes. So that's where his head is at.
Yeah, but it's okay. And he and your mom had this incredible relationship. I loved Melissa. It was a Rivers Melissa line when your mom took Cooper on these trips. And when she told him on one of their adventures that they had to leave the Vatican and instead now go to the seat of Judaism. And when the kid looked at her and said, Jerusalem, Grandma. And your mother said, no, sweetheart, Bloomingdale's. It was just so perfect. Right. That was a perfect Joan Rivers line.
Yeah, I had so much fun writing the book. And people keep, and you knew my mom, so you understood the humor in it. People keep saying, did she really say and do these things? And
she
I'm
did.
Like, no, this was this. This is a very hyper realistic. No, she never told me I had a secret brother who was perfect named Melvin. You know, she really did know the story of the real Thanksgiving. She didn't tell me that the pilgrims were bad guests because they moved the place cards, you know? So, you know, people keep saying, well, what's true in it? I'm like, well, we had Thanksgiving. There was Grandma Week. She did like going to theater, but no, she did not meet the Pope at on Broadway.
She would have in her head because she had a lot
100%,
to say.
100%. This, in her head, all of this could have happened.
No, which is funny. But I get the feeling she didn't really push you, right? I mean, you made a lot of choices that were your choices. It wasn't like her sort of saying, you got to do this, you got to do that.
You know, I think every parent in their own way pushes their child, and you just have to sort of know your audience. And her whole thing was, I would eventually come around to what she wanted me to do. And believe me, when I didn't, I would hear about it. But she, you know, just like I know how to handle my son, she knew how to handle me. And push me in the direction she thought was best. But every parent knows how to manipulate their child.
No,
I know with Cooper what I need to say.
How to deal. I know.
Yeah. You know, we just had a conversation the other day where he was making sort of this very declarative statement about something about his future. And I'm like, okay, I mean, all I can tell you is from my experience, this is what I did and this is how it worked out for me, and you can make your own decisions, and I can only tell you what I went through and from my point of view how I got there. And, you know, 2 days later he's like, you know, I think you're right. I'm like, yeah. So with him, yeah, I know I always have to be like, look, this was my experience.
Right. And your mom taught you no matter what, that funny is funny and you have to laugh even during tragic moments to get through. And you do that too with your own. I mean, the loss of your mom was not only devastating to you, but to your son. He had this incredible relationship with his grandmother.
100%. And I had to, you know, get him through it, which I think in hindsight helped me get through it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I couldn't fall apart. I had this little person to take care of. So,
right,
you know, it, you know, my parents always taught me really about focus on the important part of it and you'll get through it. You don't know it. You know, in our family, we were like, okay, you're allowed your moment. Now get up and put one foot in front of the other. And what I found so interesting is, you know, I've always been very, very strong. And so many of my mom's friends would say, like, we're shocked. And I wanted to be like, why? Why are you shocked that I'm coping?
Right, that and you're strong and you're like living your life.
And I found that fascinating.
Well, why do you think that was?
For the life of me, I don't know. Because those, and these were some of the people who were very close to our family. And I think, I don't know, maybe they were channeling or projecting their own emotions. But I remember sitting, believe it or not, at the first Thanksgiving after my mother passed and them saying, well, we're so impressed that you didn't fall apart. And we all assumed we were going to be picking you up off the floor. And I literally was like, do you know where I come from?
Right.
You know, you've known me almost my whole life. I'm shocked that you would think that. And to this day, I can't get my head around that. But you also say, okay, you know, maybe they're projecting, you know, and take it as they're proud of how I'm handling it.
You know, sometimes when there's an only child, you know, people who are looking in can't quite accept the fact that, yeah, that child is independent. That child has a life despite her closeness to her family, her mother and her father. And you've always been your own person and done what you wanted. But a lot of people just don't get that. Just like, you know, I remember, Melissa, the first time I went to your mother's house, I still remember feeling shocked because, you know, the Joan Rivers that you see on the stage or at a club or stand up and always funny and right there and cutting. This house was this gracious, gorgeous, genteel, you know, beautiful china and everything. You didn't realize it. Joan Rivers had a lot of faces. And one of them was, right?
100%. 100%. And just to go back for a sec, and because it just kind of dawned on me in a sort of strange way, I think one of the reasons people, that was so shocking to me that people really thought that, I wanted to turn around and say, do you know my family? Do you think, right, you know, the worst thing I could do in my mother's memory was not cope and fall apart. That would be so disrespectful of
right,
how
that's
I was
perfect
raised.
Way. Mm-hmm. No, you are your mother's daughter and she would expect nothing less than picking
yeah,
up those reins and being strong and giving that gift to your own child.
Exactly.
No, because both of you went through a lot. And also, I mean, you know, your mom hung out with the royals, too. A lot of people forget that, right?
Someone just asked me my opinion on all that. And I'm like, everyone forgets that families have fights. Theirs is just being, you know, yes, they're held to a different, you know, expectation in decorum. But everyone forgets families have fights.
Of course.
A family.
No, they are a family that's gone way back, and they understand how important it is to hold itself together. And I'm sure that when your dad passed away, that was a horrendous thing. And I'm sure that as this child who was strong but very sensitive, you felt a lot of anger and rage, too, because you didn't know
and
what else,
very,
right?
Yeah, but that's very typical when someone loses someone to suicide. There's a lot of, you know, first you go through the guilt, then you go through the rage, then you go through the what I call the if onlys and beat yourself up, and then you go back to, you know, being pissed off again, and then you hopefully make some peace with it. And as I always say to people, I loved my father. I respected my father. Do I think what he did was really, really, really shitty? Yeah. But it doesn't mean I loved him any less.
Right. No. And your father was a brilliant, brilliant guy.
Yeah.
And depression, no one really, unless you go through it or live through it with a family member, understand the complexity of it and the depths of it and what it does.
But also back in 87, people didn't talk about it.
Uh-huh.
It was a vastly different landscape than it is now.
But you got through it. And your mom got through it. And,
you know, again,
you know, and
what were the choices? The choice was to get through it.
But you remember all the good things. And that's what's important.
You take
the good. And you leave out the bad. And
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
The other.
And that's a lot with my parenting. And I think that's everybody. You try and take the good from your childhood and what you feel your parents did right. And you try and jettison the bad.
But you know, Melissa, your mother always thought that you were a really great parent. And she talked about it. And I always had the feeling that she was a great parent, too. But it's just a different thing. She looked at your style of parenting with such admiration.
Well, she used to always say to me, you're such a better parent than I was. And I would always be like, I don't think that's a thought you should be sharing with me. Maybe one should let her inside voice stay inside. You know what I mean?
But she couldn't do that.
I understand the compliment, but you got to understand kind of what you're saying to me. You know what I mean? That always used to make me laugh. I'm like, really? Are you trying to send me back into therapy?
Oh, that's so funny. But it was with pride. You know, you should see my kid. What?
But,
yeah,
you know, again, I don't think we should be saying, well, there were times I was a really shitty parent.
That, oh, my gosh. That was really funny. And when I think of all the holidays, and you do that, too, that your mom had, where if someone was alone, even if it wasn't her best friend, but it would hurt her. You know, and she would definitely make sure they were included. And your
100%.
Mother wasn't, right? Go ahead, Melissa.
I still have these big Thanksgivings just like she did. And, you know, bring out all the dishes that we used. And, you know, it's very special and it's very meaningful to Cooper because he has such memories of that. And I guess it was a couple of years ago we had set the table and all that. And he noticed that something wasn't there. He was like, where's, you know, whatever particular thing it was. And I'm like, oh, I didn't put it out this year. He's like, no, no. Like, it's interesting to me what he's so connected to.
Yeah. But it's persistence of memory. I always say that if I have a holiday and I leave out a dish and the kids will say, where is it? And I'll say, I don't mean China. I mean a food thing. I'd say,
right.
Well, no one likes it. And my son would say, it doesn't matter. It has to be here. And I understood. That's their history, their grandparents, their security in a way.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So tell me, by the way, guys, I'm talking to Melissa Rivers, Lies My Mother Told Me, her brand new book. So what are you up to now? I'm sure that when the book came out and you've been getting a lot of press, that you've had a lot of interest in going a step further and doing something more with this. What are you thinking?
I don't know yet. There's people are just, you know, just starting to get interested. It just came out April 12th, I believe. April 10th. It was actually, you know, dropped. So, you know, people are sniffing around. I have so many other projects going, you know, starting with my podcast and a couple of scripted projects. And it's very interesting to me that this is the book that people are like, oh, you know, this could be interesting. And you want to be like,
right,
you guys are just catching up.
That's, well, you know, it sometimes takes a little time. And your mom always used to say that even though famous, successful, she was not part of Hollywood or part of any of those inner circles. And do you feel that way? You were a Hollywood kid.
100%. I, you know, everyone's always like, oh, you know, can, you know, when I was with the podcast, they're all like, well, you can get anybody you want. And I'm like, I don't know anybody. I was raised in such a non-Hollywood environment. And I've continued that. I have one close friend from college that is in the entertainment business.
Right. And that's Pam. Right.
Right. I have one that's a documentarian. And then outside of that being my inner circle, I have other friends sort of in outer layers that are in the entertainment business, but I'm not hanging out with anyone that the paparazzi would care about.
Right.
It's just not who I am, and it's not who my life, you know,
right.
My life is much more, and but also that's how I was raised.
Mm. And Cooper too. He's not a Hollywood kid.
No. And again, he went to school with some kids, you know, who had famous parents or famous grandparents. Mm. But I also think it's how you differentiate. And, you know, I had such a traditional childhood where we sat down to dinner every night and, you know, to the day my mom died, my friend called her Mrs. Rosenberg.
Mm.
So,
which is so
that's
interesting,
sort of the way,
right?
So interesting. And that's how Cooper was raised.
Well, you're doing a great job. And as I said to you in the beginning, your mom would really love this book. It would give her a lot of laughs and a lot of pleasure. So thank you. All the best to you, Melissa. I look forward to talking to you again and following your interesting life and career path. Take care of yourself.
Thank you. Joan, you know how much we love you.
I thank you, Melissa. Lies My Mother Told Me.
I'm glad that you understood how funny the book is.
Yeah, but it's funny. But you meant it to be funny.
Yeah, but people keep asking me, which is crazy, did she really say and do these things? And you're like,
no.
She wasn't psychotic.
She was just funny.
She was just funny, and I got to channel that.
Yeah, it was great. No, I'm telling you, they'd both be proud. All right, honey. Take care.
Thank you so much. Take care.
We'll talk again. I'm Joan Hamburg, and you're listening to WABC.
The First Lady of New York Radio.
This is Ask Joan.
Well, people are always asking me, what's new? What can I do? I want to come to the city. I want to do something that's really fun and interesting. So let me tell you, purely by chance, I was wandering on the Upper East Side, and I remembered someone had said, there's a museum that's really beautiful in a townhouse at 15 East 84th Street, closed on Mondays, but they have a great show. Okay, tell me, what's it called? Institute for the Study of the Ancient World. Well, have you ever heard of that? I never heard of it. So I go over, and it was almost noon. Apparently, it's open from 11 to 6, and on Fridays, 11 to 8. And it's part of NYU, which who knew? Admission is free, and on Fridays, which is when I happen to be there, there are free guided tours at 6 o'clock. You don't need a reservation. So what is it, this study of the ancient world? It's an independent research center within NYU that cultivates comparative and connective investigations of the ancient old world from the Mediterranean to East Asia. And we walk in this lovely place, and there truly it was a take-your-breath-away exhibit. Pompeii in color, the life of Roman paintings. Unfortunately, well, for me, fortunate, it was up and functioning and gorgeous. It's only going to be on view until May 29th. The colors, we're talking about things that go back before the first century. The colors are unbelievable. The yellows, the red tones, was a great show. And if you're listening, try to do it. It's not long, but it's like unexpected. And when you think about humans and what they do, and obviously Pompeii, you know, was destroyed by the volcano, but in excavating, they found all these wonderful paintings. And apparently there were a lot of very rich people in this Pompeii community, and they had wonderful art. And these were the things that they found buried in the remnants, in the ruins. It was really beautiful. And it presented 35 frescoes, important works, all originally from Roman homes. Many of them were of dynamic mythological scenes, landscapes, still lifes, portraits. And it's an interesting way not only to learn about ancient painting, but the taste and the values of the Romans who live with those works, plus the techniques used by the artists. We would never see this, and almost never exhibited outside of Italy. They invite you to go beyond the ashes of Pompeii, this tragic city, and instead experience the vibrant world of the ancient Roman homes as the Pompeians themselves knew it. And you know what was also interesting? When the Romans came in and took over, they didn't destroy the works of the Greeks and other people. They preserved them, and it was quite wonderful. So if you want to learn more about the show, go to their website, and you can really pick up all kinds of information, and they have a digital component. So if you can't get in, you can see it all. The next major show here isn't going to be until the fall. And by the way, if you do go, they have very strict COVID. So a lot of people in the city are not wearing masks anymore, but they require masks when you go into this show. So check it out. I know you're going to enjoy it the way I did. and be amazed. I was. I mean, I was going to try to go back and see it. So I saw smallisaw.nyu.edu, and this is the Institute for the Study of the Ancient World. And it, I mean, human beings are extraordinary. All right, guys, I'm looking at the clock. It's 3 o'clock. We do this every Sunday starting at 2. So I look forward to your joining me next week too. And finish up this Sunday by celebrating life and love and adventure. We'll do it again. I'm Joan Haber.